Hi, well, my name is Andy Tillison. I'm a kind of 53-year-old music composer. I've been writing and composing music since I was a child. At the moment, I am the leader and keyboards player and lead singer with my own musical unit, a band called The Tangent, which is made up of a group of session musicians from all over the place, in fact. Whereas got some members of the band live in Sweden rather than England. It's a project that's been going for 10 years, and we've made 7 albums for our German record label, which is called Inside Out, part of the Century Media EMI group. And we've run a kind of like alternative existence from the mainstream of British media for the past 10 years. Before that, I was still writing music as far back as the late 1970s. So that's me.
Okay, so with this new album then, I was wondering whether, because it's the centenary of Stravinsky's Rites of Spring, whether there was any kind of links between your album, which translates to the Rites of Work, is that correct?
The Rite of Work.
The Rite of Work. And I was just wondering if there was any kind of tie-in or link with that. Are you kind of paying any homage in terms of the
Absolutely.
album?
Stravinsky is one of my big faves, going right back to childhood. I've really liked The Rite of Spring, The Firebird Suite, Petrushka, and Stravinsky's earlier ballet-oriented stuff for a whole lifetime. And working in the rock medium and progressive rock medium that I'm in, I realise that there's quite a lot of debt owed by the progressive rock scene to Stravinsky. I've always wanted to do it. In fact, I actually started. I did a version of The Rite of Spring, got halfway through it, and the publishing company that owns the rights to Stravinsky banned me from continuing, which was an acute disappointment, as I'm sure you might be aware. But then, so essentially, it had to be abandoned. I kind of started thinking, well, okay, what I want to do is try and write my own. I think the idea with doing a Stravinsky's original piece was that, he'd written a piece which was his impressions of the countryside during his lifetime, and the pagan rituals that go on in the Russian countryside. Me, I had a, you know, when approaching his original piece, I kind of thought, well, let's try to update it, and we made it about modern rituals in the countryside, which is kind of like bank holiday, everybody going out there, people with bicycles all over the place, and people putting barbecues in the middle of car parks in Burnsall, and generally floating tins of Stella Artois down the street and all that kind of stuff. And so we did it from that point of view, but unfortunately we got stopped. So when I approached the new piece, I still wanted to do the whole ritual thing. And rather than do that, I wrote my own piece, which is about the ritual of going to work every day, and why we do it, how we feel about it. And I wanted to make it an album that was very much about the normal person, you, me, everybody who has to get up in the morning and make that journey into work, and it's a linear piece in that it runs from it runs from the morning till late night, and you kind of just, well, it doesn't really, it's only an hour long, but you take part in it, and you go through the day, the working day, as the piece unfolds. And of course, the important thing to stress is it is a rock music piece. It's a piece of rock music that's used a lot of classical techniques within it, which is something I was very interested in as a small boy, is the when I first started discovering rock music. Because I was into classical first. I particularly liked the people who used classical structures within the music. And there was a lot of that around in the 1970s. And it kind of became a little bit forgotten and overlooked, and unfashionable indeed. And I've kind of decided I'd like to reboot it. I'd like to put the idea in people's heads again.
So, I mean, for a lot of people, I mean, you've just kind of touched on it there, is this idea that I suppose prog rock died when the Sex Pistols arrived, really. And I was just wondering, like, what I suppose prog rock means in 2013.
It's an unread page. It's a very, very interesting unread page. You know, it's it is a strange thing. I mean, you know, and you mentioned the Pistols. I saw them in 1977. 78. And it was a really great show. I really enjoyed it. And I saw Yes within 2 months of seeing the Sex Pistols. Has to be said, there were an awful lot more people at the Yes gig than there were at the Sex Pistols gig. And the fact is that contrary to popular myth, at the Sex Pistols gig, the entire place was full of long-haired hippies who looked like me, not full of people who look like your idea of what a punk rocker looks like. A lot of that was hype. A lot of that was the kind of the grognard going on about, you know, how appalling this one. And the Daily Mail, of course, who were just outraged, as they are, by everything. I think that the only person dressed in punk clothes on the day I saw the Pistols was Susie, from Susie and the Banshees later. You know, she was at the time just a kind of like person who hung around with the Pistols. So I don't necessarily agree that punk killed prog. I think that the industry in 1977 was in 77 was a time where industry re-seized control of various different forms of media, and it wasn't just music. You know, you'd had this period where suddenly the lunatics had taken over the asylum. The early 1970s was the time when the musicians made the decisions, when the film directors made the decisions. So to take it completely away from music, in the cinema you had Peckinpah and Ken Russell and Roman Polanski and all these kind of weird directors doing all this kind of really weird shit. And, you know, everybody's going, whoa, what the hell's happening here? But in 1977, Hollywood decided, we want control back. We want control. Blockbusters, Spielberg, Lucas, Jaws, Close Encounters, Star Wars, you know, that's what happened in 1977 in the cinema industry, and it was the same. They wanted things they could control, and they wanted things that were cheap. So we got punk rock, you know, and that was it. A lot of people believed that one had to die so that the other might live. Far too many people thought that, and essentially we lost something really good when that happened. The press at the time, the New Musical Express, Melody Maker, Sounds, were all kind of in their own way responsible for it, as was, you know, a great hero of mine, John Peel, you know. But the fact is we did lose, and a lot of the bands who had been making really good progressive rock music then had to try to work out how they could continue to exist outside the prog field. And of course then you got bands like, you know, Genesis, who became this sort of, you know, Armani wearing super pop group, who, you know, and I find it embarrassing to think that, you know, that they were once my heroes, because, like, you know, make no mistake about it, Genesis were the Muse and the Radiohead of their day, except much more weird than any of those two. I mean, Genesis were the kind of people who, you know, you'd hide if you saw them coming down the street because they were so weird, man, you know? And then suddenly, you know, if you can imagine Radiohead becoming Wham, that's what happened to Genesis, you know? they became Wham, and, you know, well. And of course, this has kind of like definitely tainted people's views of what prog was. Prog was a very psychedelic thing. It was about fusions of different kinds of music from all over the world. It was about disobeying rules. It was about ripping up the book and doing that whole kind of, what, the business cliche, thinking outside the box, bringing things together that did not belong together. You know, in many ways, it was a kind of forerunner of DJ culture, you know. In that, like, you know, a band like Yes used to mash up Stravinsky with television theme tunes of the day and stick, you know, rock bass lines and heavy metal and classical structures in it. You know, for a band, they were doing what Fatboy Slim is doing now, you know, in his cut-ups and mash-ups. You know, they were really rather innovative people. And it's all tended to be judged on it's all tended to be judged on sort of like people who wore capes and had too much equipment, and you know, and that's not really what it was about, actually. It really wasn't about that, but the media kind of decided, well, that's how we'll portray it. And you can't really get through a documentary about Prague without hearing about somebody wearing a cape. But there was only one person in the thousands of musicians who were involved in the movement who ever wore a cape. That's it. Yeah.
Have you ever worn a cape?
I've never worn a cape, no. I mean, do I look like I've worn a cape? Well, I suppose I might do, actually, but yeah. No, I don't wear capes. Musically, you know, I grew up just as the Sex Pistols were reaching their moment, and punk for me was my starting point. You know, that's where I came, because, like, you know, in 1976, you know, prog did itself no favours. You couldn't get into a prog band unless you had a bleeding LRAM, in, you know, from the Royal College, you know, and because you needed to be a phantom. I couldn't play like that, you know, so I joined a little new wave band and did a bit of punk and did a bit of alternative and got influenced by Joy Division and XTC. And the thing is, you know, because, like, you know, the thing is that we are a progressive bunch, all of us, because, like, punk didn't stay punk for more than 27 minutes. Yeah. No sooner had the Sex Pistols and the Damned had that first explosion of energy than, you know, you had Talking Heads and, you know, I'd say XTC and sort of like the bands who wanted to develop it, and, you know, that spread off into another completely different area.
So with those kind of post-punk bands, I mean, they were, I don't know, I suppose, engaged in almost trying to pick apart what punk could be and what musical genres could come into the punk mix. I mean, is that kind of what you're doing with prog now? Are you trying to almost pick apart the genre, as it were? Is it a kind of philosophical project?
I think that a lot of it depends on how you actually interpret the word progressive when applied to the word progressive rock music. I don't actually see it as the manifesto that some people see it. A lot of people see that progressive rock means it's got to progress, then the next album has to be a progression on the first one. That's just not it, you know, as far as I'm concerned. That's not what it's about at all. Progressive music, to me, is music which progresses. In other words, that, you know, it's not going to be made out of a verse, chorus, middle, like, intro. It will perhaps start off, take you to point B, take you to point C, through D, E and F, and return to C, and then, you know, and there'll be lots and lots of different sections in it. It's a musical journey. It's a kind of progression through the music itself, and that's how I've always seen it, even since being a child, because I got into this stuff when I was 12. All I've tried to do all the time, you know, when I was working in new wave bands, was still make music that had sort of, you know, a bit more of a story to it, a bit more of an edge, a bit more involving. And I genuinely think that, you know, whether it's time for it to come back or not, it doesn't matter. I think that a lot of people have missed out on the genuine adventure you can have in a piece of music, because, you know, I've actually suggested to, you know, to a young person, they say, oh, have you written some new music? And I said, yeah. Can I hear it? Yeah, of course. It's an hour long, and you see this kind of look of worry, horror. They've just committed to listening to a piece of music that's an hour long. I mean, obviously, you know, I like a lot of pieces that are 20 minutes long, and people are almost indignant. You've written a piece of music that's 20 minutes long. I said, yeah, do you know, it's nearly as long as an episode of Scooby-Doo, I say. And, you know, try to put it into context. Is that music itself started off as the big entertainment feature before we had movies, before we had, you know, 24, before we had, you know, the big TV series. Before there was any of that, there was music which was the program, you know, and you either listened to an opera, or you saw a ballet, or you listened to an orchestra playing a symphony. And to me, I got such an amount of pleasure out of a long format piece of music, and I've seen that an awful lot of people have never had that experience. And back in the 1970s, I mean, you know, a man called Mike Oldfield, who is very well known, came forward and delivered essentially this long piece of music that was completely instrumental and had all sorts of different instruments doing all sorts of different things. you know, it was one of the world's greatest success stories in terms of musical history, because it gave people a new experience. You know, the kids who'd been listening to pop music had suddenly got this experience of a 40-minute long piece of music that they could get lost in and immersed in, and you know, that's all I want to do, is to write something that immerses people in just the music, you know, maybe a cup of coffee, to sit down and listen to it, no pictures on the screen, just the music, let the music take you there. Because honestly, you know, when I get there, to that point when I'm listening to a piece of music, I really feel sorry for the people who've forgotten how to do that, or forgotten that art of how to actually just listen. Because, you know, so much of the music we hear now is a background for something else. You know, you either have it on when you're washing up, or it's the background music in a video game, or, you know, there's always a video on with it, or you're dancing, or, you know, it's in the background in a pub, you know. I actually do like the purity of it, and that's what I'm focused on doing, is delivering music that needs nothing else to stand up. It's just that.
So do you think then that, I suppose things like iPods and, you know, the kind of MP3 culture, the file sharing culture, do you think that's kind of, almost devaluing music and making it more transitory and kind of...
Yeah, I think there is a sort of, a general valuelessness to music that's come around, in that, like, you know, I felt it myself, you know, that having access to, on the computer screen in front of me, I've got access to nearly any piece of music I can think of in the world. And so the question is, with the ease of access, do you ever sort of like bother, or do you just move on really quickly? And, you know, one thing I've always remembered is that I used to work at Harry Ramsden's fish and chip shop just after I'd left school, and I used to save my pocket money up to buy records, and I bought this record by Genesis, The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway, which is one of the most involved pieces of music they ever did. And I bought the thing, and it cost me £4.25, you know, which was a seriously big amount of money for a kid working at Harry Ramsden's during his holidays. And I bought it, and I brought it home, and, like, I didn't like it at all, you know. I thought, oh, and it was horrendous. I've wasted all my pocket money on this blooming album that I don't like. So there was only one solution: learn to like it, you know. And I just played it and played it and played it, and of course got to, like, you know. And then, so the thing is that I know every note, I know what's going to happen next, you know. 40 years later, I know exactly what's going to happen, know every sound, and have analysed it backwards and forwards and everything. And it's that's a kind of value that I feel a lot of people now won't get, you know. I teach young people who are, you know, very interested in music, but they have a slightly different way of looking at them. You know, there is one lad who always insists on playing the first 10 seconds of his favourite records and never seems to be able to quite make it till the end of them and everything. And I don't necessarily think that that's a bad thing. He's kind of exploring things at the moment. But I don't think, you know, he actually thinks he's really in a punk, which is a good thing to be into. It's a great thing to be into. But I don't think he's discovered his real muse yet, because otherwise he wouldn't be flicking through 10 seconds of each song, or, you know, or 30 seconds. I mean, he does play a bit longer than 10. But, you know, I think that it's because he hasn't found what he's looking for, to use a rather sort of like cliched, hackneyed rock phrase, you know. That's it. You know, he hasn't found it yet. And punk wouldn't have done me forever, you know. I loved it while it was happening, but I knew that this is a, you know, this will keep me occupied for a couple of years, you know, but I couldn't have listened to, you know, the Pistols forever. I think they just about had their 15 minutes, didn't they? If you actually add up the good Sex Pistols tracks that were ever recorded, it probably comes to 15 minutes, so Andy Warhol was dead on there, yeah.
Okay, so, I mean... Obviously, you're based in Otley, which is,
yep,
you know, in Yorkshire.
Yeah.
And, you know, I suppose I was just wondering to what extent, you know, the local area or Yorkshire's kind of inspired your work, or, and especially on the latest album. I mean, is there anything you can kind of draw on from the local area? Or?
I mean, you know, I am a kind of like proud Yorkshireman, and always have been. I've lived in different places. lived out over in Cheshire, and I've lived in France. I was in France for a few years, and I very much like France, don't get me wrong. But strangely enough, I mean, like, whilst I was in France, I was going through a rather difficult time and wondering what to do with my life. And I remember hearing a record from the Music of the Spheres album by ex-Stone Roses singer Ian Brown. And there's a track on there called Northern Lights Calling Again and Again. And, you know, and I just kept on listening to it. And I kind of just woke up one morning having gone to sleep listening to it yet again and thinking, shit, I've got to go home. You know, I've got to go back. And you know, it's. I suppose I'm very parochial because I'm. You know, I'm a Yorkshireman and I'm a Wharfdale person. You know, I just love this dale, this little valley. Well, it's not a little valley. I just love this valley, and to me, it's like a great album that I've known all my life. Like I was just talking about, is I know where all the roads go, how to get, you know, all my favourite places, and there's a particular seat up on Beamsley Beacon where I go and sit and write my music, write my lyrics and think and just completely switch off. And it's my favourite view across Wharfdale. And, you know, you can see everything. You can see towns, you can see villages, you can see reservoirs, little hills and Bolton Abbey and all that kind of stuff. And you can even hear steam trains whistling in the distance. It's a glorious place to be. And so I've written about quite a lot of the places. I mean, Blubberhouses, which is a fascinatingly named little village just up near Fewston, up the road from here. That figures in the new album because, the rush hour in the cities does have its effect on the countryside as well. And strangely enough, this tiny little hamlet that has nothing to do with the rest of the world, there is a church and a pub and a couple of houses and a reservoir. But you know, it has a traffic jam through it every day as people try to go from Skipton and Harrogate. You know, there's cars whizzing all over the place on the Skipton Harrogate main road, the A59. And you know, I kind of almost look at it and think it's not really fair on Blubberhouses, is it? Because nobody's going there; they're just going through it. And so that's where I put the pin in and started my virtual day in this piece. Is I thought, well, we'll start here at Blubberhouses. As traffic's going on its way to the various places, in the half light, the moment of dawn, you know, everybody on their way to work to this tiny little village that doesn't even know what's happening. So
I mean, with this kind of, I mean, you, what I'm getting is this kind of philosophy of songwriting as storytelling,
yes,
as creating a narrative rather than, you know, and I'm just wondering, like, I mean, to what extent do you work from the concept or do you work from the music?
I have to say this is actually the first fully fledged concept album we've done. Now, I mean, we're a progressive rock band, which, of course, going to the normal cliche, means we've already released loads of concept albums. No, this is our first one. And rather than be some kind of like airy-fairy, Tolkien-esque, Jules Verne,
tarot cards.
rather than do something like that, you know, being a realist, being a kind of like what you might call a moderate, nice guy anarchist, you know, that's what I kind of like think of myself as. That's my little self-image that I see when I look in my mental mirror. Is that, like, you know, I wanted to write about something that's real, not you know, back in the day, you know, in the 1980s when I was writing prog rock, rather than write about Mordor and the orcs, you know, I didn't need to because the SPG and Thatcher were pulling down the pits and, you know, and Scargill was sort of there and he was kind of a hero for me at the time, you know. So, you know, I'd rather have written about that than fiction, you know. I want to write about my own life and the stuff here, you know. So, the concept on this album did come first. I knew I wanted to do this thing. I knew I wanted it to be about work, and I knew that it had to be linear. Therefore, that I was going to need a beginning, a middle, and an end, and everything, and the whole thing would unfold as the story of a day. And of course, that meant I had to work hard to make it go within it. To me, the most important thing, if you're going to write a piece of music that's got vocals in it, that's a song. And the songs have to be good. And you know, from that you need to pull away from all the kind of like, you know, skills and clever tricks of prog rock and everything. You've just got to go back to what it is that makes a good song a song. And, you know, for that reason, I actually do a lot of my writing on an instrument I cannot play very well, which is a guitar. So that I will focus on the chords, on the vocals, on the melodies and everything. And then once I've actually got a decent song organised, I will start embellishing it with the sort of like, you know, the pyrotechnics and all the flashing lights and the fast keyboards work and the big arrangements and stuff. Yeah. But, you know, when I find really good songs, you need to go back to people, you know, their Tamla Motown, you need to go back to sort of like, you know, people like Tom Petty, Graham Parker, Elvis Costello, Bob Dylan, the Beatles, you know, people who write great songs, and you like work out how that is and then work out where you want to take them after you've written that kind of song. And that's really how I did the record.